Thank you. Our Alpha course started on Monday, which is a cue to Dennis to get the DVD in the right place. Don't play it yet, Dennis, okay? And it's an interesting opportunity to refresh your understanding of the Christian faith, to go over the basics again of what Christians believe and how they practice their faith. And each evening there's a video which is set up to open the discussion afterwards. And the videos have been remade and, in my view, are excellent. They feature interviews and scenes from around the world. It's not just one talking head. And in this first video, a couple of people shared how they came to faith, how they encountered God. Nikki Gumbel talks about being raised as an atheist, but going to university and being challenged as a trainee lawyer to investigate the evidence of Christianity. And he'll explore more of that, how we can be sure Jesus existed, the Gospels are historical, the resurrection happening in this week's episode, which is a plug for you to maybe come along on Monday. There was an interview with Bear Grylls, the celebrity adventurer, who describes his faith as a backbone for his life, helping him to face the storms and whatever may come at him, but also how God still loves him despite the mess he makes of his life. And there's an interview with Francis Collins, one of the world's leading scientists who heads up the World Genome Project, mapping the millions of DNA in our bodies. And that's what I want to show you now, how he describes his conversion to believing in God as a scientist. Away you go, Dennis. Technology. Let's pray.
Genome Project, mapping the 3 billion letters in the human DNA, considered by many to be the most significant scientific undertaking of our time. He describes how he encountered Jesus and came to believe in the truth of Christianity.
Well, in the home where I grew up, faith was not something that was talked about very much. My father was a professor of drama, my mother a playwright. When I went to college and those discussions in the dorm late at night about religion began to occur, I had no particular reason to attach value to a faith system. It had never been something I was familiar with or had internalized at all. And I assumed that any religious feelings that anyone held must be on the basis of some emotional experience, and I didn't trust those, or on the basis of some childhood indoctrination, which I felt I was fortunate to have missed. I loved the experience of learning about the human body and all of the components of that, and I particularly loved being introduced to genetics. But then I ended up in the medical school curriculum sitting at the bedside of patients with diseases. This was no longer an abstract study of molecules and organ systems. These were real people. And one afternoon, one of my patients, a wonderful elderly woman, much like a grandmother, who had very bad heart disease, she had a particularly bad episode of chest pain while I was with her. She got through it, and at the end of that, explained to me how her faith was the thing that helped her in that situation. She realized that the doctors around her weren't really giving her that much help, but her faith was. And after she finished her own very personal description of that faith, she turned to me, and I had been silent, and she looked at me quizzically, and she said, "What do you believe, doctor?" And ultimately, I had to admit to myself that her question had made me realize that I had arrived at an answer to the most important issue that we humans ever deal with. Is there a God? And I had arrived there without ever really looking at the evidence. And I was supposed to be a scientist. If there's one thing scientists claim they do, is to arrive at conclusions based upon evidence. And I hadn't taken the trouble to do that. I was greatly assisted by a pastor who lived down the road who I went and asked about all this and who gave me a copy of C.S. Lewis's wonderful book, Mere Christianity, because here was an Oxford scholar, a prodigiously developed intellect, who had traveled the same path. Within those pages, I realized for the first time that one can come to belief on a rational basis and that, in fact, given the many pointers that one sees around oneself in terms of the universe and it having a beginning, and its fine-tuning in terms of the way in which all those constants that determine the behavior of matter and energy seem to have been set just in a certain very precise range to make life possible, and many other things, including my beloved mathematics and why they actually work anyway to describe the universe, something that makes you think the Creator must have been a mathematician. That brought me then to the person of Jesus Christ as a person who was historically extremely well documented. That was news to me. I thought Christ was as much myth as history, and I realized after reading more about it, this was a historical figure upon which we have a great deal of evidence for his existence and his teachings, and even his rising from the dead in a literal way. That day at my patient's bedside started a journey for me. A journey that I was reluctant to begin, but I felt I needed to. A journey that I thought would result in strengthening my atheism, but to my surprise, resulted in my conversion.
There's a difference between
knowing facts
about someone and...
So in that clip, you saw how encountering a woman who was in hospital, going through a hard time, she saw the difference her faith made to her life, and it made him ask questions. He was challenged by her question, well, what do you believe? And he went away and explored the evidence and the arguments, and he thought his way into faith, and his thinking about God became knowing God. Head knowledge became heart knowledge. So I encourage you to consider the Alpha Course and also to commend it to friends and family. This month we've been looking at the theme of God's provision. We've been using the story of Moses to highlight this. And most people know about the escape from Egypt and the parting of the Red Sea. And last week we looked at the story of the giving of the Ten Commandments. The Israelites wandered in the wilderness. And this week we see how Moses wanted to know God more. He wanted to see God face to face. He wanted to meet God. And how God provided an encounter for him to help his faith. While God was giving Moses the Ten Commandments, the rest of the Israelites were making an idol of gold, the golden calf, and they were having a wild party. They wanted something visible, something before their eyes, something to represent God. And Moses finds out and throws the stone tablets at them. God threatens to abandon them. And then Moses has a heart-to-heart with God and has a bit of a rant. And he pleads with God, the whole thing won't work if you don't come. The people want your presence. I want your presence. And God gives in and says, my presence will be with you. Having gained some ground, Moses pushes further. He pleads again, show me your glory. It's as if he's saying to God, look, we've been through a lot. We're going to go through a lot. I don't really even know you that well. I don't even know what you look like. You're asking a lot of me, of the people. Couldn't you just show us your face? I don't know if you ever prayed that prayer. God, just show yourself. Show me your face. Show me your grace. Maybe it's a prayer of doubt. Maybe it's a genuine seeker's prayer. Maybe it's a prayer for encouragement in the face of trials or even tragedy. I need help. I need something to help me holding on. I know in times of tragedy, people can cling to faith in God as their only hope. In tragedy, I've known people find faith in God. I've also known people lose faith in God. You can never predict how a person may react. Didn't stop people asking questions of faith. People like Moses asking God to show himself. When Mother Teresa was visiting one of the most horrendous slums in the world in Calcutta, she was asked, how do you explain all this in the light of your claim that God is a loving God? Why does God let these things happen? And Mother Teresa answered, well, when I see him, he's got a lot of explaining to do. Maybe that's why she lived so long. Every time she approached death, you can imagine God saying, hey, hold on a minute, don't let her die yet. You know, I can handle her. And of course, when we celebrated the 20th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana, Mother Teresa died on the same day, although that's been forgotten, sadly. The Bible has many parts where writers question God, wanting to know where God is. It's an honest book at times. Next month, we'll have that annual Remembrance Sunday, and we'll recall the atrocities of war where rules go out the window, and it's often kill or be killed. Whenever anyone escaped from Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration camp in Poland, the SS guards would arbitrarily choose six people to hang as a way of discouraging further escapees. Any prisoner who contemplated escape would know that six innocent people would die. After one escape, a 12-year-old boy was among those chosen for the torturous death. And when the trap door of the scaffold swung open and the boy fell and his body weight was too light to snap his neck and kill him, instead he hung there, squirming and shaking for about half an hour until he slowly choked to death. And as he hung there, shaking in the cold of the evening, one man asked another, "Where is God? Where is God while all this is happening?" And the man, he asked, pointed to the boy at the end of the rope and said, "He's there. God is right there." And it's an ambivalent statement. You could read it as if God is dead and of no use. You could read it as if God is in the pain and the tragedy, seeking somebody to redeem it and transform it. And the Christian story has tragedy and glory. It has death and resurrection. It has suffering and joy. And Jesus on a cross, for us Christians, is God who is no stranger to the tragedy of life, yet gives no easy answers to the tragedies of life. You know, I do believe in the power of prayer. We've seen remarkable things happening in this church. But I also know many prayers don't get answered in the way we want. There's always a great mystery about life and a great mystery about God, which is evident here in this story of Moses asking to see God's face. And God's well-known reply is, "No human being can see my face and live." And God will put Moses in a crag in the rock and cover his face with his hand and pass before him in all his glory, but then remove his hand in time for Moses to see God's back, the backside of God's glory. What exactly is the message God's sending to Moses? That he's not ready for this intimate face-to-face, that you can't really understand God. Is it an insult because God is still a little hurt about the rejection from the Israelites and not quite ready to make up completely? Or is there some truth to the "no one can see my face and live" thing? What Moses sees might be something like the wake of God's glory, the end effect of God's full frontal passing by. It's as if Moses, and indeed all of us, has no ability to comprehend the fullness of God, but perhaps only the resulting impact of God's presence in the world, in history, in the lives of us all. We can only see God's glory in hindsight, looking back. Yes, maybe there. Now and again, I do believe we do get some glimpses, maybe sightings of God's glory in our midst, flashes maybe of God's backside. I've just been on a retreat to Lindisfarne, Holy Island, and it allowed me to stop. It allowed me to enjoy God's creation. Martin Luther said creation is God's second book of revelation. And we glimpse God's glory in handiwork all around us, beautiful sunsets, gorgeous birds singing away, seals waving at you, big open skies that open you up to the transcendent God. But we also have more intimate personal revelations. I remember an old lady I knew who suddenly lost her son, and she was devastated. And she confided with me that she cried herself to sleep most nights. "Why, God, why?" was her lament. She fought to keep hold of her faith, even of her life. Was it worth living anymore? She felt guilty for complaining to God. What did God owe her? It's a good question. How can we, God, be in our debt? What right have we to complain? One night as she lay in bed, she described how through her tears she had this picture in her mind of Jesus approaching her. And he said no words of condemnation, no words of justification or explanation, no words of judgment. He just came with tears in his eyes. And as he opened his arms to embrace and comfort her, she noticed the nail marks in his hands. And she thought about those stories of Christ's appearances to his disciples after the resurrection, how his wounds remained. They may have been healed, they may have been transfigured, but they still remained. And that picture, that very biblical picture of that wounded Christ embracing her in her pain, helped her to find the courage to carry on. It was a glimpse of God's suffering yet resurrection glory through Jesus Christ. I'm sure I've told you my own father died over 20 years ago now. It was awful to see him struggle for breath, seeing him die before my eyes. And the night before he died, I remember praying to God for help and strength in this trial. And the words, "He's safe in my hands," came to me. And the next day, being at his bedside as he breathed his last breath, his last words with me too was, "I'm safe in God's hands." And the use of that same phrase that I'd received in prayer the night before was such a real gift and such a great comfort to me at that time of loss. And speaking personally for myself, you know, I had faith to believe that this wasn't the end. For me, my faith encouraged me to believe that the final word was not going to be this tragedy and this awful death. And I had hope. There's glory to come. There's glory to come. One day, of course, we'll all know whether God is real. Doubt will be taken away. Christians believe we'll see face to face. We will come home. We'll truly see God's glory, a glory unspeakable that will transform whatever we've endured in this life. And even now, when we accept Christ in our lives, when we invite him to be present alongside us by his Spirit, Paul writes in the second letter to the Corinthians, we've got this sense of the glory of the Lord being with us through his Spirit. And that's what many of you already know. You can have that assurance within your heart. God is with you, not to condemn or judge, but to bless, to forgive, to love. It's a spiritual thing. And you can ask God, even today, show me your face. Show me your glory. Cheddar Gorge is just down the road in Somerset. One day in 1763, a young church minister was caught in a tumultuous thunderstorm in the cliffs nearby. And the minister, Augustus Toplady, took refuge in a cave and found himself reflecting on the way the rock of faith provides us with shelters from the storms of life. He, in fact, died of TB at the age of 38. But the words of his hymn, "Rock of Ages, cleft for me," formed themselves in his mind at that experience. And its opening line is a riff on this story from Exodus. So the story and the hymn have in common the insight there are aspects of God's own being that will be a threat to us, but that God in person saves us from these and seeks to bless us. Shall we stand and sing it now? Number 365 in your hymn book.